there was a narrow ledge with a sharp drop. Dido put her foot on the rocks to make sure. The rock crumbled. Scree skidded down the rock face.
"Are you all right, sir?" she asked the general.
"Yes," Bendict said, but it was difficult going one-handed. He was halfway across the ledge when he slid and set off tumbling clouds of rock dust and scree that gave their position away. Lasbolts flared about him as the enemy pointed his shape out among the mountainside. There was little cover. Dido made her way back to him. She took his elbow and helped him slide along the rock face. She was cool, determined, fearless, even as the lasbolts started to hiss past them. Dido kept her head down. There was a sharp retort of ordnance. The ground before them exploded suddenly, and Dido was thrown backwards. She heard the scream as the blast threw Eon off the edge. Dido scrabbled for purchase as she slid down the steep slope. She grabbed at whatever was to hand. A bush snapped. A clump of dry grass came away at the roots. She dug her fingers into the gravel, and the stones fell towards her. Dido cursed as she felt her feet go over the edge. All her movements felt awkward, as if she were wearing an extreme environment suit as she slid into cover. It was like being in the military scholem again, Minka thought. The seconds were like heartbeats.
"Laptev!" she roared.
The pause was painful. Then Victor appeared, crouching low, and one by one the rest of the squad came forward. Laptev was last. She lobbed a frag grenade round the corner, then dashed forward, but one of the dead suddenly leapt up. His blade caught the top of her helmet. She grunted as she buried her bayonet into his guts and twisted, a simple trick she'd learnt in the early days, when they had practised by stabbing inanimate dummies lashed to a stake in the ground. The gush of hot blood on her bare knuckles brought her back to the moment. The body slumped towards her. She sidestepped it and kept moving. Through the smoke, she could see the burning remains of a cargo six. Bodies were slumped over the rear ramp, and flames licked up the side. Shand was still behind her, bolt pistol smoking in his hand.
"Laptev!"
she shouted. Her voice was getting hoarse now.
"What the freck is wrong with him?"
Shand had his bolt pistol ready.
"Sergeant Lesk, failure sits at the door of the commanding officer."
Minka lost Donson before they reached the far side of the square. If only they'd shoot Shand, she thought, as she threw herself into the porch and heel-kicked the doorway open. It opened into a kitchen or storeroom. She took the room in at a glance. A flight of stairs, antechambers to either side, loaded with sacks of rice and flour, each one stenciled with Munitorum letters. Shapes were moving through the room above. She shot one through the broken floorboards and fired at another as he hurtled down the steps. His words were cut short as her lasbolts punched him back against the wall. He slid and fell, his legs crumpling beneath him as she took the broad steps, two at a time. The remains of her squad were with her. They reached the top of the stairs. She engaged her voxbead.
"Laptev!"
she shouted. There was a pause. There was no answer. Minka risked a look behind her. For the moment, she had to keep her fury restrained.
"Laptev, get the freck up here!"
Hard rounds shattered the brickwork on the other side of the street. Minka leapt up. There was the dull rattle of heavy weapons on the floors above. She smashed a loophole and ordered her fire teams to form up. Someone was firing at them. The shots were wild and sporadic. The Cadians hugged the walls. Minka ducked into the window and fired, then ducked back again as the enemy returned fire. Plaster fell from the ceiling above her.
"Keep moving,"
Shand hissed. Victor and Rustem had kicked a hole through the wall to the next building. She ducked into a family's dining room, shoving the chairs and table out of the way. Shand was right behind her. She had no idea where Laptev was. Drino followed up first, then Thaddeus, Silas and Victor, his grenade launcher primed with frag. Victor knelt for a moment and braced himself, then fired a grenade up the hallway. The charge exploded from the barrel of his gun with a bang and the hiss of compressed air.
It was as ungainly as a flying fist. It glanced off the wall at the top of the stairs. There was a moment's pause, then the frag charge exploded. The sound rolled down the stairwell towards them, smoke clouds following in its wake. Minka ran to the top of the corridor. Two of the enemy were lying where the blast had killed them. A third had been hit in the face. He was sitting with his back to the wall, hands held to his eyes as if he were crying, but it was blood, not tears, that poured between his fingers. She let Thaddeus kill him as she secured the intersection. The corridor split left and right. There were oil paintings hanging on the walls. One of them was shredded, the broken frame only held together by scraps of the landscape. Behind it, the gilt wallpaper was freckled black with shrapnel. She looked back. She only had half her squad.
"Where the hell is Lapdev?" Minka asked them. "Is he hit?"
"He's coming," Drino said.
Minka cursed.
"Lapdev, get your frecking backside up here!"
She hollered down the hallway. Then she engaged her vox and spoke in a different voice entirely.
"Colonel Sparker, building taken. Pushing forward."
She flicked the vox speed off. Tyson didn't have to hear the rest.
"Drino, I'm relying on you. I'll take the others forward. Cover us and then assault. Understand?"
She caught Drino's eye. He nodded. Victor took another frag grenade from his belt pouch. He fitted the heavy black charge into the launcher's muzzle and looked for Minka, as if to ask which way she wanted it firing. They were 100 feet up on a narrow goat track when Dido slipped. Benedict was right behind her and threw himself forward. He caught hold of a low shrub and swung his foot down.
"Catch it," he ordered.
Dido grabbed the general's boot. Her feet were hanging over the edge. She felt them both slide and knew this was going to be the death of both of them.
"Hold on,"
Benedict ordered her.
"Sorry, sir. You're too important. I can't drag you with me."
Benedict cursed.
"Hold on, Dido. That's a damned order."
Mia edged along the narrow ledge. He grabbed Bendict's stump and took some of the weight. Dido had started to slip again.
"Hold on, damn you,"
Bendict hissed as his whole body tensed.
"Or I will hunt you down and shoot you."
Dido felt her fingers slip. She cursed. Falling off a rock wall was not how she had thought she was going to end her service to the Golden Throne. Chapter 8. As chaos engulfed the Grotto Chapel, the Pedrizzo had fled. Meroe was not with him, but Urin was more than enough protection. One arm was about the Pedrizzo's shoulders, while the other held her Carthay foresword out before her, batting any attack away. She was a hand taller than the Pedrizzo. He had never quite got used to the fact that she could be both so slender and beautiful, yet also so deadly and threatening. It was a scramble through the rear of the Grotto Chapel, past the clerics and choir boys, to a private doorway set between the black marble tomb of one of the Pedrizzo's consorts and a kneeler monument to a general named Wilbert Richstar of the Western Rangers. The biolock responded to his touch. Urin covered the doorway before slipping in after him. Then the door closed behind them both, leaving the others to their fate. The Pedrizzo was trembling as Urin led him along the ancient catacombs. Generations ago, the rich stars had indulged in all kinds of nocturnal assignations, and the catacombs had gone from being a place of rest to a way of moving unseen. Most of these passages had long been sealed up and abandoned, but there were still enough to allow for swift passage between the Calvert, the Basilica, and other shrines and barracks of the Acropolis. And there was only one place to which the Pedrizzo wanted to go at this moment of crisis. It took a little more than half an hour before they reached the designated chamber. The Pedrizzo made the sign of the Aquila as he put his hand to the biolock. When the doors parted, he stepped inside and moved into the dull glow of the stasis field, which uplit his face. Urin stayed outside the door. Inside the vast dome, the saint's body lay still, the expression unchanged. Only moments before, that face had been on the figure in the chapel as it writhed in agony. He mumbled a prayer.
"What happened?" he whispered.
But if the saint's soul heard anything, there was no sign.
Was he supposed to die?
There was no answer, and the Pedrizzo did not know what else to do, so he knelt to pray. He imagined the days before the treachery of Sebastian Thor, the pure faith that had been founded in the earliest days of the Imperium of Man. Here, at St. Ignazio's tomb, the old faith, with its art and icons, had remained unchanged, unpurified, heretical to the minds of the present ecclesiarchs. Generations of rich stars had lived in that pure faith. They had worshipped in the cathedral when the fortress was manned by Fratiris Templars, and his family had ruled from the massive bastion of the basilica. All he wanted was to bring that back, that glory, that closeness to the God Emperor.
"Speak to me, forefather. Send me a sign. Have I done wrong? All I have ever wanted is to return our people to the faith of their ancestors."
The door opened and a dark-robed figure entered. The stranger put two hands to his hood and slid it back. It was Ordinand Vettor. The Pedrizzo leapt up.
"What happened?" he demanded.
Ordinand Vettor was calm. He smiled. What was supposed to happen? The Pedrizzo shook him.
"But he died."
He looked shaken.
"Charlia died."
Of course. That was what was foretold for him. The Pedrizzo didn't understand. He shoved Vettor away.
"What are you talking about? He was supposed to lead the Brotherhood in a great crusade to Holy Terror. What is going to happen now?"
"The great crusade has begun. They have already taken half the system."
"I don't know what you're talking about. The fall of the Cadian Gate confirmed all the prophecies. It is the sign that we have all been waiting for, a sign that our enemy's rule is over, a sign that our time is ripe."
The Pedrizzo stepped back. It had been a long time since he had been called on to defend himself, but no rich star reached adulthood without a rudimentary knowledge of self-defence. A needle pistol appeared in his hand. He lifted the pistol, but found Vettor's grip about his wrist.
"Who are you?" he spluttered.
"Stop," Vettor said.
His voice was low. There was a strange command in the syllable. The Pedrizzo lifted the needle pistol and fired. Except he didn't. He tried to move his arm, but it would not move.
"Put that down."
The Pedrizzo looked down in horror as his fingers opened and the needler fell from his grasp.
"What are you?"
"I am the Ordinand, the one who is ordained. The bringer of news was destined to go before me to make the way clear." The Pedrizzo was trying to make all this fit the secret signs and prophecies that he had grown up with.
"So you are the one who was prophesied to liberate us?"
Vettor put his fingers to his lips.
"Shh, no one is going to listen to you anymore. The blood of the rich stars has run thin. You are weak, corrupt, immoral. The saint has no more faith in you. Your time, Pedrizzo, is over."
The Ordinand lifted the needler from the floor. He turned the gun in his hands. It was a fine weapon. He put the needler to the Pedrizzo's neck.
"Urin!"
the Pedrizzo shouted, but Vettor shook his head.
"She's dead."
The Pedrizzo struggled, but he could not move. Vettor fired. Blood bubbled from the Pedrizzo's mouth as hemorrhagic venom began to liquefy his insides. The Pedrizzo's dissolving physique began to run to the floor. Within seconds, his remains fell like a wet sack and burst. Part 5. Shout to the Emperor, the rock of our salvation, in whose hand are the depths of the earth and the peaks of the mountains. For he is the Emperor, and we are the pure and the holders of the truth, the sword in his hand. Psalm 666. Chapter 1. Saint Ignazio had spoken. The cardinal was unworthy. The portents for the future were dire. From the Grotto Chapel, a tsunami of fear and anger rippled outwards. Mobs sated their despair by smashing and burning and stealing, hunting down symbols of law and order, and indulging in violent murder. Chief among their targets were symbols of authority and oppression, and the physical manifestation of that were the city's enforcers, who were being hunted down and beaten to death. Chief Enforcer Rudgard Howe knew he was alive because he hurt so badly. He'd barely escaped with his life, and his black carapace armour was blistered and charred. He did not dare look under the plates to see the damage to his body beneath. Rudgard limped down the narrow steps towards the lower city quarters. There was debris everywhere, smashed windows, broken furniture, torn up cobbles. At the end of Holy Street, the local enforcer depot was ablaze, the dead crew lying in the street where they had fallen. Chief Enforcer Howe had no choice. He had to go this way. He approached the crossroads warily. If only he could reach the mouse hole. He had a number of faults that he was well aware of. Chief among them was his stubbornness. If he stripped off his suit of black carapace armour, he might just make it to the mouse hole without being marked. But he refused to do that. It was against his nature. He'd inherited it from his great-grandsire, and it had kept him alive more times than he liked to remember. He was still approaching when a pair of boys spotted him. "There's one!" the cry went up. More shouts followed. Rudgard pulled his pistol, and the gang backed off for a moment, gathering strength. They shoved and egged each other on, working themselves up to a pitch of courage necessary to charge him. Any moment now. There was no point in running. Rudgard Howe stopped in the middle of the crossroads and lifted his pistol to firing position. "First one dies," he said. His low voice carried enough threat and warning to hold them back. They hesitated. No one wanted to be the first. He backed off slowly, got to the corner of Redemption Avenue and edged into a doorway. He felt behind himself, found the handle and pushed the door open. "Right," he said, "I'm going through here. And if anyone follows me, I'm putting a round through their stupid skull. And then I'll find out who you are and come down on your family and take you all to the mouse hole, and then you'll wish to the God Emperor that you forgot all about me. Understand?" They did not respond. They were young and hungry, and they sensed a wounded beast. He could see in their eyes that they were losing their fear of him. He slid through the doorway and pulled it shut behind him, slamming the top bolt lock into place. He tried to close the bottom one, but it was rusted shut. He cursed as he ran along a dark corridor, looking for the back of the tenement. He reckoned the door would give him 10 seconds reprieve. From the sound of splintering wood, he realised he'd only been given half that time. He ran through a communal kitchen, still littered with rolls of breakfast bread, platters of beans, pots of oil. The rear door had a simple fly screen of knotted string and cheap plastic beads. He tore through it into a kitchen garden, neat rows of garlic sprouts, a lean-to shed against the side wall, and a square wooden water butt against the rear wall. He flung himself up. His arm gave way with the pain, and he snarled as he heard the gang behind him drawing closer. From the top of the butt, the top of the brick wall was within reach. He scrambled up and cursed as he pulled his hand away. There were glass shards set into the mortar. He had no choice and jumped again, but his carapace glove saved him this time as he swung a leg up, caught the lip of the wall, and then dragged himself over. It would slow his pursuers down, he thought, as he dropped down to the other side. He was in a narrow street, dark in shade, and overhung with balconies,
strings of hanging chilies and sacks of meal, kept out of the way of rats. He didn't recognise it, but it looked like one of the old lanes that wound along the contours of the Acropolis. He ran to a doorway opposite, kicked the door open, and dashed inside. The air was cool and smelt of fried onions. He pushed along the narrow corridor, past an old man in underwear and stained vest coming out of the toilet, through a simple kitchen.
"Oi!"
the man shouted. Rudgard clambered up the roof of the outside toilet and dropped into another garden, this one set 10 feet lower. He didn't know this part of town so well, but he had a sense of where he was heading and swung round corners, past piles of rubbish, up weed-strewn alleys. A cat yowled. He almost ran over a child. A mother was carrying a basket of clothes. She shouted at him, a string of curses chasing him up the street. By the time he reached the next main street, he was sure he'd lost his pursuers. He stood in a dark room, heavy with worn velvet curtains and a smell of mildew. An old, infirm lady hissed at him from her wooden chair.
"Where am I?" he demanded.
"I know who you are," she spat.
"So do I. Now tell me, what street is this?"
She cursed him and he laughed.
"Save your curses, Grandma. My mother said worse to me many times."
She was still spitting his name as he opened the door onto a high porch with old coats and a low stack of firewood set against the wall. A tall, narrow staircase of dressed stone led down to the road. He was 3 steps down when a half-track swept past, throwing him backwards. It was full of rioters chanting the Emperor's name. 2 more half-tracks followed immediately after, throwing up dust from the street. The third had a heavy stubber on the back of the vehicle. Rudgard crouched back into the shadows. He gave them long enough to pass along the road, then slid out of the doorway. This was Atonement Avenue. He took the shady side and limped along Martyrs Avenue, gun ready. The long, straight artery of Martyrs Avenue gave him a clear view down. It was a mile or more to the enforcer's compound. The air was hazy with heat and dust. The street was full of rioters. He could see fires, crowds and, over the top, the low rock-creep buildings of the enforcer's base. But there was no way of getting there from where he was, not dressed in black carapace. Howe limped back up the hill to take the winding narrow streets and drop down to the mouse hole from the north. The streets were quiet. People here were hiding, their doors shut and locked. A few shouted at the chief enforcer. They called him "that frecking boffier," street slang for the enforcers. He kept on hurrying across each side street, where he had brief images of the violence below on Martyrs Avenue. Each time he expected to see the violence decreasing, to see a wall of enforcers driving the enemy back, but instead he saw gangers wielding enforcer shotguns. The closer he got, the more uneasy he felt. He risked a quick look down the street. The gates of the compound were open, crowds milled in and out. Archives were being broken open, records being thrown into an improvised incinerator. Data servitors were being dragged out of their data sockets, the brain-numbed savants mewling incoherently as they were beaten to death with clubs and wood. But, most chilling of all, he could see bodies hanging from the gateway, the black-clad bodies of enforcers. Chief Enforcer Rudgard Howe had grown up in the Enforcer Command Depot when his father held the position he would go on to inherit. He'd spent his entire life within the Enforcers. He knew each commander, had known many of their fathers as well. Now, as mobs rampaged through the city, he did not know if any of the men he'd known were left alive. He didn't, in truth, know if he'd be alive by the end of the day either. The sickening realization hit him. The mouse hole had fallen. He was now a fugitive in his own city, a marked, unmistakable face. He laughed at the irony of it all. Now he was on the run. He threw himself back into the doorway and tried to think. Where next? He had to get to the Calvert. He'd be safe there. Rudgard limped back up the street.
He heard the roar of a bike and had a bare moment to react, slamming his bolt pistol into its holster and pulling his stub pistol out. The biker was a blur as he passed along the bottom of the steep street. Rudgard fired instinctively. The report was loud and sharp in the narrow canyon of tenements. The bike kept going, but a second later there was a screech of metal and the tone of the engine changed. He limped towards it as fast as he could. The shot had knocked bike and rider sideways. Both of them skidded along the road. The rider was a ganger. He lay 10 feet away and did not move. The bike was rammed up against a rockcrete barricade. The wheels were still spinning. Rudgard limped out. He could hear the alarm being raised, but they were too far away.
"Shout, you frickers,"
he hissed, as he pulled the bike upright and kicked the engine back on. He got a feel for the pedals. It was standard Munitorum issue. Stolen, no doubt. The front headlight was cracked, the mudguards scratched and dented. He swung his boot over and the machine bucked forward. He held on for dear life as shots rang out, slaloming through the crowd. Some of them cheered him, thinking he was dressed in stolen armour. There was a roadblock ahead. A leader, bearded and armed, held his hand up and directed Howe to stop.
"Who are you?"
he demanded.
"Rudgard Howe, chief enforcer,"
Howe said, and shot the other man through the head, then gunned his bike forward with a screech of rubber. The Evercity was burning by the time Howe reached the culvert. The entrance was barred. He shouted up at the guards who trained their weapons on him as he swung in through the ornamental gateway, set his bike against the wall and limped through the palace gates. 2 witless Calibaneer were on duty on the palace doors. He waved them away as he pushed his way past them. The culvert had a strangely deserted feel. He was suddenly aware of how he looked and smelt. The stink of smoke and cordite hung about him.
"Where is he?"
Rudgard demanded. The servants scattered before him.
"Where is that half-brained idiot?"
No one dared stop him. He entered the Pedrizzo's private chambers and found the door locked and 2 lifeboards with bronze body armour and helmets standing outside the door. They were not Marui or Urin.
"Access is denied," one of the lifeboards announced.
Rudgard paused.
"I'm Chief Enforcer Howe," he said. "I do not care who you are."
The other lifeboard lowered his power lance and engaged the activation stud. Rudgard cursed. He held up his hand in a sign of peace.
"Where is Marui? Where is the Pedrizzo?"
"None of your business."
"I'm supposed to be running this place. I need to talk to him. Do you understand that?"
The other lifeboard spoke. "The Pedrizzo has gone to see the Forefather. The Ordinand will pass on the message."
"Great.
You're wounded." Rudgard forced a smile.
"Right.
I will see that the physician attends you."
"You're too kind."
Chapter 2 Dido let go of Bendict's boot, but she did not fall. His hand shot out and gripped her wrist tight.
"Up you come,"
he gasped as he dragged her back over the long drop.
"Let me go,"
she shouted. He ground out the words.
"Don't tell me what to do, Sergeant. I am a general in the Imperial Guard."
She cursed silently and held her tongue. The Cadians all worked together, a human chain with a one-handed man pulling Dido back from the brink. Her chainsword snagged on the edge. It almost tore free. It was a struggle, bringing them all to safety, but they were a team. She struggled up the last few feet and dusted herself down.
"You shouldn't have, sir," she told him. "I mean, putting yourself at risk." "You're a Cadian," he told her. "That means more to me than anything else. One day, there'll be none of us left. So let's put that time off for as long as we can. Now, before we do that, let's get around this hummock of rock and get out of the sight of those people below."
Rudgard waited in the yellow room, a small, intimate boudoir on the middle floors of the Calvert, with yellow satin ottomans and embroidered chaise longue, and a series of landscape paintings giving the place a light and airy feel. It had been used by the previous Pedrizzo for private entertaining. It was snug, comfortable, and only a little musty from lack of use. The rumour said that the last Pedrizzo had entertained his many mistresses here, and maybe this was why the current incumbent had not favoured the space. Rudgard had only been here once before. He felt awkward. He was too dirty to sit on the yellow satin and had no interest in the art that hung on the wall. He was in pain. There was a knock on the gleamwood door.
Who is it?
Scanio Primus. The door opened and Scanio let himself in. He was a small, thin man with a monocle augmetic that stood an inch out from his nose, a set of Medicaid servo limbs that arched over his back, and a fussy, overprotective air.
Chief Enforcer, he said, stepping forward and taking in Rudgard's appearance, I heard that you were injured today.
I'm burnt, Rudgard said.
Yes, I see that. Any other wounds?
Yes, I cut my fingers.
Rudgard slid off his right glove to show the cut. It was on a joint and it stung with sweat. The physician swept forward.
The Ordinand and the Pedrizzo are praying together. They asked me to come and tend to you.
Rudgard nodded.
That's very kind.
Shall we sit there? Scanio said.
He pointed to a small table by the only window. The surface was inlaid with hexagonal pieces of wood that created the impression of a three-dimensional pattern. Rudgard did as he was told, but he didn't warm to the medic. Scanio sat opposite. His fussiness seemed an act to disguise the automated method.
Now, please, I would like to see the arm.
Rudgard took his pistol out of its holster and laid it on the table.
No injections, Rudgard said.
He stared into the medic's human eye, then the augmetic one. The red lens monocle dilated as it focused. There was no perceptible reaction in either eye. Scanio simply nodded and said,
Show me your arm.
Rudgard eased his elbow armour off. Next, he had to remove his carapace armour.
I can assist, Scanio said.
Rudgard spoke quickly.
No, it's a point of pride.
It took him 5 minutes to undo the latches on his groin armour. The plates hung loose. The medic watched him intently as Rudgard unlatched the rib buckles one-handed. His shoulder guard came away first, and then the carapace, which he had to slide over his burnt arm, being careful not to touch the wound. Beneath the armour was his black bodysuit with his tactical belt, which held his knife and concealed sidearm. He paused for a moment and then unclasped the seal and let the belt drop to the floor.
That is some sidearm, Scanio said.
Hercuta 10, Rudgard said. I got it from a naval officer. It's for ship combat. Works just as well in the city. It fires these.
One-handed, he fished a round-nosed slug as large as a child's fist from a pouch on his left thigh and tossed it onto the mat.
Hand-grip magazine. Holds 10 man-stoppers.
The medic lifted the heavy, blunt round up in a human hand.
Explosive?
Soft tip, Rudgard said, taking the slug and slipping it back into his pouch. Expands on impact.
I know, Scanio said. In fact, I have seen the wounds weapons like these make, usually when performing an autopsy. Very effective indeed against any kind of soft tissue.
I suppose that's your job, medic, and mine is keeping men like you busy.
Scanio didn't get the joke, or if he did, he didn't smile. His red augmetic eye blinked slowly as Rudgard opened up the seals of his bodysuit and lifted the cloth from his shoulder. He slowly peeled it down his arm.
I can help, the medic said, stepping forward.
Rudgard held out a hand.
I said I'd do it.
His tone was sharp.
As you wish, Scanio said.
When Rudgard had stripped to the waist, he sat across the table and laid his burned arm down between them. He winced, It was worse than he thought. His arm had been flayed by the fire. The skin had fallen away in sheets, and now the pink flesh oozed blood and clear fluids. He moved his fingers and stared with curiosity as he saw the fibres of the muscles contract. "You have been burned."
"I can see that."
One of the medic's augmetic arms appeared from over his shoulder. It was a syringe arm.
"No," Rudgard said. "No syringes. Humour me. I had a bad childhood experience."
"I will need to clean it."
Rudgard nodded. "Then clean it."
"It will hurt."
"I know."
Rudgard clenched his fist. He could see his muscles move in response. It made him feel queasy. He ground his teeth. He would not show pain. The syringe arm folded back into place as the medic rattled in a tray and finally picked out a pair of sharp metal tweezers. They were needle-pointed. Rudgard swallowed. He grimaced as Scanio carefully picked away scraps of burned cloth and laid them in a small metal tray. Some of them were threadbare. All were charred. They mounted up, one on top of another, all wet with blood and clear serum.
"Ah," the medic said at one point, holding up a wet drape in the tweezers.
"That looks like skin." Rudgard felt nausea rise with the pain. "I'm afraid that there is a lot of dirt." The syringe appeared over the medic's shoulder. "I recommend that I take away the pain." Rudgard took his left hand out from under the table. The medic's augmetic eye clicked as it focused.
"Another weapon?"
"Yes." "That is a needler."
"Yes, it is," Rudgard said.
"Why are you pointing it at me?"
"Because I do not trust you," Rudgard said. "If that syringe comes near me, I fire. It is loaded with toxins that will stop your heart in seconds."
"This is not appropriate. I do not perform under threats of violence."
"I don't care. Just do what you have to do. Clean the wound and strap me up."
The medic's human eye looked shaken. "The Pedrizzo sent me."
"I am aware of that," the chief enforcer said.
"I am the best."
"At what?"
"At healing the sick, repairing the wounded."
"Then shut up and start cleaning," Rudgard said.
The chief enforcer watched as the ends of the tweezers worked into his flesh. The pain was intense. Blood started to well up from the holes. It poured warm and wet over the side of his arm. Rudgard gritted his teeth. He started to sweat. He felt sick. He kept his eyes open as Scanio wiggled the fragment from his arm. When the piece finally came out, the medic held it up. The augmetic eye clicked and whirred. "Shrapnel. Crack grenade markings here and here." He dropped it into a metal tray. It rang out and lay in its own pool of gore. Scanio hunched forward. A siren wailed, and another. Scanio pulled another sliver of steel from Rudgard's arm and then looked up.
"I hear there is unrest in the Evercity."
Scanio spoke as if this were a distant, almost passing concern.
"I think it's a revolution," Rudgard said.
"What would people have to revolt against?"
"Their fate,"
Rudgard said, and laughed at his own joke. The pain in his arm was throbbing, but he could not waste time here. "All foreign objects have been extracted," the medic said at last. "I will now clean it." He looked up. "This will hurt."
"Pain is a sign of life," Rudgard said.
Scanio paused, assessing this piece of information.
"Yes," he nodded.
"Or imminent death. You have served the Rich Stars well, but I am afraid that now your service is at an end." Something in the medic's tone gave Rudgard a moment's warning. As he spoke, Rudgard dropped down and to the right and heard the thud as the syringe embedded itself into the backrest where he had been sitting. Rudgard threw the table up and himself backwards as Scanio came at him again. Rudgard's arm was agony, but he held on long enough to fire three needle darts. There were enough toxins there to stop a Grox herd, but Scanio didn't seem affected at all. "If you think your poison will work on me, Chief Enforcer, then I regret to tell you that you are mistaken."
Rudgard emptied the magazine into the medic's chest as he backed into the corner.
"Nerve toxin," Scanio said, as if sampling the poisons that ran within his body. "Yes, if I were a street ganger or a carabineer, I would be dead now. But medicine has been my life, the art of living and the art of death."
Rudgard looked to see where his pistol lay. He knew many tricks, but he did not have any to get himself out of this particular mess. He let the medic come almost within range, then threw the needle pistol into his face. It was a cheap ganger trick. Throw sand, throw anything. Howe kicked out with his booted foot, slamming into the medic's chest. Scanio fell backwards, but as he did so, the medic's needle stabbed out and embedded itself into the 2-inch rubberized soles of his combat boots. Rudgard twisted his foot, punched the medic, and then threw himself back, hitting the floor. The pain from his wounded arm almost blinded him. He cried out in agony as he slid over the carpet. The medic had grabbed the needle gun and aimed it at him.
"Nerve toxins," he smiled and stepped forward. "I am sure you know the effect that these will have upon your system."
Rudgard said nothing. He knew perfectly well how the nerve toxins worked. One dart induced uncontrollable spasms that racked the body within seconds. The last man he'd killed with it had spasmed so hard his muscles had broken almost every bone in his own body.
"Goodbye, Chief Enforcer Howe," Scanio said, and pulled the trigger.
Chapter 3 Benedict led Dido's squad up the rocky path. It was dangerous going at times, but they had quickly climbed out of earshot of the Evercity, the smoke and gunfire growing distant, replaced by the breath of mountain air and the buzz of crickets in the thorny grass. Benedict kept a fast pace. He knew that the enemy had a march on him, and that the forces of the Imperium were on the back foot. This was the moment of crisis that could end his career, and probably his life, or not. Throne be damned, he was not going to end his, or any other Cadian, life on Portence. Not without a fight. Half an hour later, General Benedict, Mia and Dido's squad were lying in hiding in the deep flood gutter at the side of the road, listening to the gathering noise of a vehicle coming towards them. Welt hissed to Dido,
"If I'd known I was going to end up in a ditch, I wouldn't have worked so hard on my creases."
She looked at the dark dress trousers of his number one uniform, then at her own. Her trousers were torn and dusty.
"I'll be glad to get a dressing down at the next parade," she told him. "I remember you said that," he told her.
The Cadians crouched low as the first Cargo 6 came around the corner. From the Rockcrete storm drain at the side of the road, they watched it approach. It was passing them by when suddenly a grenade exploded and the vehicle jumped from the ground. The report was a loud, high crack as it echoed off the rock face. The Cargo 6 hit a metal road barrier and skidded before flipping over. There were screams as the passengers were flung out over the side of the mountain. The second Cargo 6 came to a halt with a hiss of burning tyres. The driver was trying furiously to keep control of the vehicle as he slammed the brakes on. Dido was first up. She lobbed a grenade. It hit the bonnet and bounced left. The explosion tore the tyres to ribbons and hid the side of the vehicle in a cloud of coloured smoke. Hard rounds started to fizz through the air about her. She did not have to look back. She knew the other Cadians were with her. Time seemed to slow as she ducked forwards, throwing her pistol into her right hand. She had left her chainsword behind and, regretting it now, she pulled her knife out in a reverse grip. One of the enemy leapt out. He was a young man with a thin ginger beard. She fired 2 shots straight down into his gut. She was over him in a second, running into the smoke as a figure loomed before her.
She could not slow down, and shot the second in the face, bending low to shoulder barge him out of the way. Welt shouted, "Another cargo!" The odds swung wildly against them once more. She felt the deep thud-thud of a heavy weapon go through her bones. She did not have a moment to look round and see what the hell was happening. Benedict unleashed a furious salvo of incandescent red bolts and felt the rumble of a vehicle coming up the road behind them. Mia pushed him back and stood before him.
"Run!"
he shouted at his commanding officer. "Go!" It was too late. Down the slope came the rumble of a tank and the sound of psalms being chanted.
"Throne!"
Benedict cursed. They were trapped, with the enemy coming up and down the hill and them in the middle. The sound of singing grew louder and the new arrivals swung around the corner. It was a black tank with fluttering pennants and a series of golden tubes rising behind it. At the front was an armoured cockpit with Stormbolter and behind it the pale face of the woman taking aim. Benedict felt as though the weapon were pointing straight at him. Then flames and smoke flared from the dark barrel openings and he fell to the ground. A fuel tank exploded. The noise was deafening. But Benedict had not been hit. As the hail of fire came to an end, he lifted his head. The torrent of shots had torn through the enemy. A red mist rose from a charnel slop of heaped and confused body parts where men had stood. One of the warriors still lived. He crawled towards them on hooked fingers, dragging the ruin of his lower half. He was hissing, "Faith in the Emperor, faith in the Emperor," over and over. Dido put a las bolt into him. The tank that had come down the hill came to a halt with a hiss of brakes. Its heraldry was a black cup filled with flames. A black power-armoured woman stepped down. Her boots rang out on the rock-crete roadway. The bulk of her armour exaggerated her petite frame. She had close-cropped dark hair, a tattooed face, and a steel aquila etched onto her armour. There was nothing frail or weak about her. She exuded confidence and strength as she strode forward and put out her hand.
"Greetings. My name is Celestian Simona. You are men of Cadia?"
"We are. I am General Benedict."
"What are you doing here? Why are you not with your warriors?"
"I was at the service this morning," Benedict started.
"I am looking for our canoness, the Holy Madalena."
"Then I am afraid your search is over. She died this morning with the Cardinal."
Benedict briefly described the scene earlier that day. Celestian Simona watched him closely. At the end, she said,
"I do not know who you saw die this morning, but I can assure you it was not Cardinal Zerium."
"What do you mean?"
"When we drove off the attackers, we sealed the Acropolis so that none may enter. I went to the Basilica and searched it. We found Cardinal Zerium's body in his chambers. He had been beaten to death. But tell me, you saw our canoness fall?"
"She died fighting those who call themselves the Brotherhood. We were too far away to help."
Simona looked at him with compassion.
"Forgive me, General. You are a one-handed man. How could you help our canoness, who I have seen fight on 100 battlefields?"
A shadow fell over Simona's face. She made the sign of the Aquila, and when she spoke, there was emotion in her voice.
"But tell me, did our canoness die well?"
"She was a lioness. The dead were heaped about her. I heard her die with the name of the Emperor on her lips."
Simona nodded. She swallowed back her emotion and set her jaw.
"Your words bring me comfort. She died in grace. Her martyrdom will fortify us all."
A tear began to bulge on her lower eyelid. It surprised Benedict. He had not had much to do with the Adepta Sororitas, but he had never imagined them to be subject to human emotion. But there was no weakness in her display. Even as the tear dripped down her left cheek, she set her jaw in a hard and merciless expression.
"The Holy Acropolis has been defiled by heretics. The authority of the Imperium upon this planet has been betrayed. We have a great battle before us.
Indeed we do, Benedict said. If you can take me back to my barracks, I will drive back our enemies.
Celestian Simona nodded.
We will do our best.
She pointed to Dido. She may come inside our tank, but the rest of you must ride on top.
Chapter 4 Minka squad were in a narrow three-story hab block, holding off a gang of young men, when the message came over the vox, loud and clear on all channels.
We have General Benedict.
Chief Commissar Shand stood to the side of the window and fired his bolt pistol. Three rapid shots that brought dust filtering down from the cracked plaster ceiling. There was an explosion. Minka needed to hear the message again.
Are you sure?
She demanded. There was a long pause as she risked a quick look over the windowsill. She fired off a quick burst.
Lesk!
It was Sparker this time.
Affirmative. Benedict is safe. He is on the way to the barracks.
Shand had clearly heard the news as well. He fired another salvo.
Order your squad, Sergeant. It is time to pull back.
Minka slammed another power cell into her carbine.
Sir!
She shouted to the Commissar.
Laptev! Back! Laptev?
There was no answer. The enemy were breaking in downstairs. They could hear shattering windows. Hard rounds impacted the floor where she had been standing. The floorboards disintegrated under the weight of fire and clouds of plaster fell from the ceiling. Shan's voice was calm but urgent.
Command your squad, Sergeant. Maintain good order.
Minka dropped a grenade through the hole in the floor. She evacuated to the next building before the blast went off. She shouted down the stairs.
They're in the building! Victor!
Get Laptev's team to withdraw. A young man charged through the doorway where she had just been. She swung around and hit him in the chest.
Go! Minka shouted.
She put her gun around the corner and fired off a wild salvo, then threw herself through the hole in the wall and down the steps. Hard rounds shattered the wall behind her. The Cadians retreated through the holes they had broken in the interior walls. At the end of the row, she fired off a quick burst through a first-floor window. The enemy responded from a number of vantage points. They were zeroing in on her. She fell back as brick dust swirled about her. A grenade bounced off the wall above the window. She swung round the doorframe and threw herself down the wooden stairs. A grenade exploded behind her, in the room she'd just been in. Shand was waiting for her at the bottom. He caught her arm as she skidded down the stairs.
Are you ready, Sergeant?
Yes, sir.
She felt less threatened now and was almost reassured by his presence. She risked a quick look out of the doorway. They'd come a long way. It was going to be a long run back. Donson's body was lying exactly where she'd last seen him, but she saw that the Cadians were still holding on at the other side of the square.
We're going to cover you, Sparker voxed.
He counted down from five. On two, Shand pushed her out and Minka started running. As she and the Commissar broke cover, the Cadians who were dug in on the other side of the square opened fire with everything they had. Minka had a brief impression of searing blue light. She could smell the ozone as the bolts flared past her face. She had a panic that she'd be hit by her own side. She bent low, running hard, conscious of Shan's tall shape just behind her. He ate up the ground in long, loping strides. She passed Donson's dead body and kept going. With 20 yards to go, she thought she might just make it. Something had changed, she realised, as she reached the far side of the square and skidded into cover. She caught her breath, counted her squad, and then spun about and saw Shand.
Are you all right? He said.
Yes, sir.
He held her gaze for a moment too long.
Good, he said.
Minka waited till Shand was out of sight and then threw herself at Laptev, slamming him with her open palms.
Where the freck were you? She raged. What the hell were you doing out there?
He fought back, but she was powerful in her rage
and she knocked him down and stood over him. It was a long time since she'd felt such primal rage at a fellow Cadian.
I lost 2 men out there. Both of them were better than you. We're a unit. You need to step up. Do you understand?
She felt her squad gather round. They were shielding her from anyone else's view. It was a silent show of support. She grabbed him by the collar and shook an answer from him.
Yes,
he said at last, and she threw him back to the ground and cursed. M Company fought their way back up to the barracks as sleeper cells of the enemy threw bombs or barricades across the roads. But the Cadians were tough veterans, with chimeras, able to hold their own. They pulled back to intake barracks as columns of the Brotherhood armour rolled into the lower reaches of the Evercity. Lemon Rust tanks, chimeras, half-tracks and cargo aids all wound along the streets, with black-robed warriors sitting on the backs, waving Rich Star banners and the yellow banners of Vandir. The Brotherhood cheered wildly as they passed the burning enforcer block and moved into the old city, with its narrow streets and overhanging houses. By lunchtime, yellow flags hung from all the main towers of the city, proclaiming a return to a world and a faith that had remained hidden for thousands of years. The Brotherhood took each quarter of the Evercity, then set to work, destroying what they considered idolatrous iconography. Pictures of Sebastian Thor were torn down or defaced, while his statue in Faith Plaza was toppled, and his marble head tossed, chipped and cracked onto the cobblestones. Saints, holy men and women were defaced and broken. The tombs of Sisters of Battle were treated to special bouts of rage. Their mausoleums were shattered, and the musty, browned bones were scattered in the streets. By mid-afternoon, the Brotherhood had pushed their way to the upper terraces of the Evercity, where the Lemon Rust columns slowed to a crawl as they funnelled towards the narrow roads that led up to the Calvert, the intake barracks, and the massive Fortress Cathedral at the summit. The Brotherhood were already rejoicing. They believed that the God Emperor was on their side and that he had already granted them victory. All they had to do was take the fortress and the planet would be theirs. In the command bunker of intake barracks, Benedict and Celestian Simona threw a plan together to hold the Acropolis against their enemies. If they try to take the cathedral, my sisters and I will throw them back, Celestian Simona assured him.
Will you be able to hold against tanks? Benedict asked.
She looked at him with a mixture of contempt and pity. General, the walls of the faithful are impenetrable to the unworthy. Benedict smarted.
Are you accusing the Cadians of being unworthy?
I am not accusing you of anything. But the Emperor's will is clear. Can you say that you and your troopers are all pure?
Pure? What is pure?
Celestian Simona gave him a compassionate look. The Sisters of the Ebon Chalice are pure. Benedict cursed inwardly.
Well, good luck to you, Celestian. I am sure your purity will keep you all safe.
Celestian Simona made the sign of the Aquila before she left. Mia had new reports for the general to read. Benedict absorbed the information quickly. By the time the lead tanks of the enemy were pushing up through the final switchback streets, the Imperium's fist was already preparing for the counterblow.
Get General Dominga, he told Mia.
When the contact was made, Mia handed the handset to Benedict.
Hold at all costs. Understand?
Yes, sir,
the Calibaneer commander answered. There was a pause.
Yes, sir, I understand. We will hold to the last.
That morning, Dominga's mountain infantry had worn their finest dress uniforms. Blue, woolen zuba with broad red silk sashes wound about their waists. That morning on parade, they had looked magnificent. Now they looked incongruous as they took up positions in front rooms, balconies, at crossroads and behind makeshift stockades of cargo trucks, handcarts, barrels, sacks of meal and rice. She was proud of their discipline. But they were a skirmishing infantry force, specialising in mountain warfare. They had almost none of their heavy weaponry and only a smattering of specialist weapons. When the lead tanks of the Brotherhood appeared at the end of Via St. Sabine, she lifted her scopes. The lead tank was a Thunderer, low profile, wide-barrelled and menacing. On the back, she could make out the faces of young men clapping and singing as if they were on a victory parade.
"Time to spoil the party,"
she said when the Thunderer was two-thirds of the way along the road. "All squads, open fire." The roar of missiles in the confined street was deafening. One missile skewed off the angled armour, decapitating a singing warrior and ricocheting into the top floor of a hab block, which exploded in a cloud of rubble dust. The others impacted head-on and detonated, filling the street with a billowing cloud of physoline.
"Hit!"
Dominka grinned, but as the smoke cleared, the low profile of the Thunderer nosed aggressively forward, now shorn of passengers, like a bull shark coming through murky waters. The demolisher cannon panned for targets. It shook as it fired into one of the buildings flanking the street. There was a dull roar as the massive shell thrummed the air. It impacted an ornate hab block halfway along the street. The building shuddered under the impact, and then the chemical core erupted, and the building seemed to lift into the air before falling back to ground and collapsing in a heap of dust and rubble. Dominka cursed as the lead tank rumbled forward. Unless her troops could do something, the way to the cathedral lay open. Reports of the fighting reached Benedict as he set up his command post in the mountain bunker of intake barracks. He started to work out who the enemy were.
"The Fritiris militia call themselves the Brotherhood," Mia said.
"And who is leading them?"
"Their nominal commander is the Cardinal."
"He's dead. Who is their military commander? Find out who and get them on the Vox."
Mia saluted.
"Yes, sir."
There was a pause as Major Kastelek hurried in.
"I have the 101st ready, sir. Just let me know where you need us."
"Thank you," Benedict said. "I am still unsure exactly what is happening here and which of the local troops are loyal. At best, the Fritiris militia are rioting. At worst, they are infected. I suspect the taint of heresy here. Have your troops on standby. As soon as we know what is happening, we will move."
Kastelek nodded. Benedict paced up and down as reports came in. The Pedrizo was not answering, but at least the majority of Calabania commanders reported themselves ready.
"Any action?"
he demanded from Major Cramack, whose troops had secured the starport.
"Scattered contacts. I've set up an exclusion zone. A lot of armour heading your way. Tanks, armoured conveyors."
Benedict went very still.
"Thank you for the warning."
The link dropped. Benedict was outwardly calm, but the air was strained.
"When are the reinforcements due in system?"
Mia looked through the day's Vox traffic.